You're listening to This is Yoga Therapy. I'm your host, Michelle Lawrence, and I've had the opportunity to interview many of those who are making a difference at the intersections of yoga and health. And I'm here to share with you their stories and conversations. Thanks for listening. In today's episode, I interviewed Dr. Ariel Schwartz. Dr. Schwartz has a private practice in Boulder, Colorado, providing psychotherapy, supervision, and consultation in resilience-informed therapy, which applies research on trauma recovery, EMDR therapy, and somatic psychology to form a strength-based trauma treatment model. I became familiar with Dr. Schwartz when I read her article in Yoga U Online entitled Six Ways to Stimulate Your Vagus Nerve with Yoga and Breathing. I've gone on to read other articles she's published on their site, most having to do with the vagus nerve and self-regulation through yoga. In this work, she draws from Dr. Stephen Porges' polyvagal theory. She's also an author of several books on trauma, resilience, and growth. And we're going to talk about these subjects a bit on the podcast today. It's great to meet you and have you on, Dr. Schwartz. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can we start by having you share with our audience a bit more about yourself? I'm interested how you came to be a psychologist and how that led you to work with trauma and resilience. And then where does the yoga piece fit in for you?
You know, I'll probably start with the yoga piece of that question. Yoga came first in many ways for me. I was initially introduced to yoga when I was a young girl. So when I was 7 years old, my stepfather brought yoga into our family, in fact, a little bit younger than that, but certainly by the age of seven, he came into my elementary school and was teaching my whole third grade class how to practice yoga. And every Friday, we would be trees and lions and cobras, right? And camels. So I feel very lucky to have been introduced to this very young. And in my family, we'd travel to ashrams at that time. So we went to Kripalu when it was still an ashram, and Amrit Desai was still there. And then we went to Muktananda's ashram. So I grew up in New York, and we would go to Pennsylvania and other areas to go to these places. So as a young child, there was a lot of awe and there was a lot of beauty and even a little bit of like, what is this? Like a lot of mystery around yoga and a lot of play. And that for me kind of still resides as a core element of how I practice and how I teach. And then like many teenagers, I was like, nah, that's not cool. So I let go of the yoga, but I also had a lot of early disruption in my life. So I mentioned it was my stepdad that brought the yoga in. My parents were divorced by the time I was four, but even those first 4 years of my life had a lot of chaos. And the chaos lodged itself in many ways in my own nervous system. So my draw towards psychology was for my own healing initially, knowing that there was a lot of anxiety, a lot of depression, a lot of symptoms that not until later did I go, oh, that was trauma. And that's why I became much more focused on trauma and understanding what we might refer to as developmental trauma or complex PTSD, that accumulation of repeated ongoing stressors. So that informed me as well. And I sought out therapy in my, by the time I was in college, that was a very essential part of my own healing. But I also returned to yoga. And when I would attend a yoga class, I would experience something that was very similar to what I imagine I felt as that young girl, is it brought me home. It brought me a sense of ease. I could feel my mind would slow down. I could rest in my body. And I wanted more of that. So the combination of seeking out my own healing and knowing that therapy was an essential component of that journey and that the body was an essential component of that journey. In the same year, this was in 1996, I completed my yoga teacher training. I went back to Kripalu for that. However, Kripalu had just gone through their own massive transition of Amrit Desai being kicked out, basically being asked to leave because of transgressions that left that whole community traumatized and healing and going through a redefining of themselves. In some ways, that was perfect because to enter into a yoga community that was also involved in healing was a ripe fit for my own journey in becoming eventually a therapeutic yoga teacher, is to really recognize, how do we step out of dogma? How do we get out of rigidity? How do we stay authentic and true and allow yoga to help us find our own voice? But that same year, 1996, I also entered a master's program to study somatic psychology. So all of that converged at once to understand how body and mind and healing come together therapeutically as well as physically.
Wow. Yeah, what a beautiful story, and just really born from your own experience in so many different ways. And is that what you would say now is the focus of your work then, trauma and resilience?
For sure. And post-traumatic growth. I mean, certainly it's my own practice and I'll share what that looks like, but certainly to encourage an embodied yoga practice, which is less focused on the outer look of a pose or pose A achieves this particular goal, but really understanding that when we're listening to the body, the yoga comes from within. And while we might visit what is a familiar posture, like a downward facing dog or a cat and cow or a warrior pose, right? There's familiarity and there's ground, but then each posture becomes an opportunity for exploration and for movement that's guided by sensations.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly resonate with that, what you just said, and that approach, and really how the yoga works. So let's talk a little bit next about the important role of the vagus nerve, because more and more, and I see this in your work and just in what I know as well, it's like so pivotal, it's so critical, this vagus nerve in terms of emotional regulation and so many things. So in one of your articles on Yoga U Online, you write that a healthy vagus nerve supports your digestive system, helps to regulate your sleep patterns, and calms down your nerves. Learning to regulate vagal tone is associated with a reduction in inflammation and better prognosis in people suffering from chronic illness, migraines, autoimmune disorders, anxiety, and depression. So it's responsible for a lot, right? So could you maybe give us a 101 on the vagus nerve here, just for our listeners to kind of get just a tiny bit more of that?
Yeah, gladly. And, you know, I think one of the common phrases that we often hear when we speak about the vagus nerve is that it's the super highway of communication between the brain and the body. And I think that's really true. And the vagus nerve gets a tremendous amount of attention these days for all of these reasons that you're giving. And it's at the forefront of a lot of research, both in terms of what we call electroceutical devices, or these bioelectronic devices that can be surgically implanted that create stimulation of the vagus nerve to manage things like epilepsy, and that provide relief from rheumatoid arthritis or from anxiety and depression, and reducing inflammation as a cause of many conditions. And then there's also this understanding that we can naturally stimulate the vagus nerve. But what is the vagus nerve? And I think that's really what your question is. It is the 10th cranial nerve. It works together with other cranial nerves. And the vagus nerve is translated from Latin to mean wandering. And it gets that term because it's connected throughout so many areas of the body. It travels from the base of the brain down into our digestive organs, all throughout our spine, into our heart, into our lungs, right through the diaphragm. It travels through the, alongside the esophagus, in through the esophageal hiatus in the diaphragm, down towards those kind of lower organs down in the belly. But also the vagus nerve travels upward. And so it's in the larynx and pharynx in the throat, and it's around our jaw. It travels into the inner ear, and it's around our eyes. So sometimes that upper pathway of the vagus nerve is referred to as the social engagement system. And that's by Dr. Stephen Porges. That's his term, because it creates this connection between our heart and our face. that allows us to express what we're feeling in a social manner to others in a way that can actually project a feeling of calmness and regulation from the inside and allows us to be a regulator or calming presence for another person.
Yeah. And so it's got such an important role. And just based on where you mentioned that it travels, you know, it comes to mind to me that deep breathing, like we do in yoga or certain practices that involve breathing, where the diaphragm is in play, can impact the vagus nerve. And things like Tratak, where we're using our eyes in different yogic practices, can impact the vagus nerve. And chanting, where we're using the mouth and the whole cranium, if you will, when we vibrate sound, also can impact the vagus nerve. So we'll talk a little bit more about it, but those are the immediate things that come to my mind based on where that nerve wanders.
Yeah, it's so beautiful that you're naming those connections. And it's a lot of what I enjoyed pulling together and studying as I wrote the Therapeutic Yoga for Trauma Recovery, which is about applying those principles of polyvagal theory for creating meaningful pathway to change. And having more of a sense of control over our own nervous system state, not control in an aggressive sense, but in a sense of that we no longer feel helpless or powerless about the state of our nervous system, that there are practices that we can do that facilitate a change in a positive direction.
And that's the beautiful thing here, right? So we're learning about the role that the vagus nerve has, and then people like yourself and others are drawing these connections around how we can engage with it in healing ways so that we can build our resilience and find ways to regulate and grow after traumatic experiences. So I think it's served us so well to learn about this. Obviously, there's a lot of damage that can be done through the trauma, but there's also now ways being brought about that we can look to our own empowerment to help us heal.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that a little bit more specifically. So you have another article on Yoga U Online. It's the one that I pulled a little bit of the context around what the vagus nerve is in that last question I read, and I'll share the links in the show notes here. But in this article, you go on to offer 4 steps to help you recover from vagus nerve disorders. So would you walk our listeners through those 4 steps and what they are?
Yes, absolutely. And I think I want to just put I'm going to call it a caveat or just a reflection, having taught this, and I imagine you can relate to this, Michelle, having taught these practices for many, many years, the first thing that I will say is that every individual is going to respond to any particular yoga practice pretty uniquely. And so even practices that we might put in the category of this is a breath practice that is calming, or this is a breath practice that is energizing. But when we teach that to the individual, what's so important is actually finding out what is the impact of that practice for that person. And what shapes that impact is our history. Yeah. Right. If we have a history of times in which we experienced a fright and as a result, we held our breath and we're in a yoga class and we're being taught to do a kombucha, a breath retention, and that holding of the breath brings back an implicit body memory of a time when I held my breath in a state of fright. What might be for one person a really empowering practice and energizing for someone else could feel really overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. And it really has to meet the individual, right? Based on where they are and whatever experience that they may have previously had. We can't assume that all of these things are upregulating or downregulating for everybody.
Exactly. And even just to pause on that terminology that you just used, because I think there's a misunderstanding sometimes when we speak about vagus nerve stimulation, that it's only downregulating, that it's an only calming practice. And actually, that's not true. The vagus nerve, when we're in a kind of optimal state, sometimes in yoga, we refer to this as sattva, right? When we're in a state of clarity and that kind of internal resonance with our own center, that centering doesn't necessarily mean that like I'm in a deep yoga nidra practice all day long. That wouldn't function in the world. right? What that centering allows us to do is meet the world and meet ourselves in a way that allows us to kind of rise up and maybe meet a challenge and notice that our heart rate has increased or our muscular engagement has increased in a way that allows us to meet a challenge, but also to have a relatively efficient recovery system so that I don't get stuck in that mobilization response, that I have the capacity to return to a sense of ease, and that we can successfully mobilize into states of play and into states of joy and excitement. And I can go climb a mountain with a mobilized vagus nerve, just like I can successfully rest into deep meditation. And that the vagus nerve actually in its optimal state, we refer to this as vagal efficiency, that actually I can adapt to different nervous system states when I'm tapped into that internal kind of superhighway of the autonomic nervous system.
Yeah, really helpful.
And so with that said, you know, what I try and offer in these four steps of recovering from vagus nerve disorders is also to say that these can take time. Having worked with individuals with chronic illness and with seizures and Lyme's disease and chronic fatigue and you name it, what we know is that these imbalances, especially when they're autoimmune imbalances in the nervous system and in the physiology of the body, that it took many, many years of accumulated, often chronic stress or viral load that led to that imbalance in the system. And even if we're practicing every day, we might not ever reverse that accumulated stress response, but we can better manage it. So all of those in a way are the kind of the caveats of these four steps. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to totally recover from autoimmune disorder, from, you know, lupus, if you're doing these four steps. But what you can do, and what I find is that even short practices done throughout the day can actually help you better modulate your nervous system. So for example, I worked some years ago with an individual with seizures, and as she began to notice and know her own nervous system states and developed more self-awareness, she was able to track pre-seizure signs that her body was giving her. And what I would say in that case was kind of preemptively add in a whole lot of self-regulating care in a manner that reduced the frequencies of her seizures significantly from multiple times a week to once a month. I mean, that's a huge reduction, right? Ultimately, I had a conversation with her some years later. She said they completely stopped. How lovely. So the four steps, now that I gave all of that, you know, kind of prequel here.
That was helpful. I'm so glad you did that. Yeah. Cause we wouldn't want to leave anyone with the thought that, you know, this is my ticket, right?
Exactly. So the first of these is around orienting to safety. And sometimes safe is a tricky word when you've experienced trauma or in living in our current modern world where there are so many ongoing threats that we're being exposed to literally every day if you turn on the news. In our pandemic and in politics and in climate change and so on and so forth. So what we are aiming towards are, what are the environmental conditions that you can create around yourself in a predictable manner that allows your body to orient towards safety, even if it's relative safety in a temporary, you know, time of practice, or orienting to a sense of peace or connectivity. You use your word, so that there is some quality of, I can access an experience of calming presence for myself in a predictable manner. Our body's not going to release the impact of trauma until there is a sufficient experience of present moment safety. So we start there. The second step is to start to build that awareness of, what are your internal cues that let you know whether you feel safe or whether there is a response to threat that's happening, so that we can actually attend to any of the anxiety or the distress. And what we often talk about in the trauma treatment world is cultivating dual awareness state. Dual awareness state is basically having one foot fully grounded in that present orientation of safety, while we have one foot touching into the remnants of times when we felt unsafe and how they coexist within us. So we can turn with that kind of one foot grounded in that sense of calm, peace, safe. And then we can start to bring our attention and dip a toe into how the body communicates memory of a time when I felt unsafe, or the experience of something very recent or current to that day, right? We all have some moment on our yoga mat. I'm sure everyone listening to this, and you and I can both relate, of being on your yoga mat, and perhaps you're in, you know, pigeon pose, right? And you're breathing into your hip, and all of a sudden this wave of sadness pops up, right? And you just allow that wave, and some tears go by, and there may be a very specific memory connected to that, or there might not, but we learn to trust that those moments are happening and that they're healing moments. And they're healing so long as we have that sufficient ground of safety in the here and now. So the third step of this, or the third part of this practice, is what we would call mindful mobilization. So remember that the vagus nerve isn't all about going into states of deep rest. It's also about kind of knowing how do we rise up to meet a moment. And often the remnants of trauma came about, and this comes from the somatic experiencing arena, or the work of Dr. Peter Levine, but he speaks about when we've experienced a trauma, that the way that gets held in the body is that the instinct that wanted to happen in the moment was thwarted. It didn't get to occur. I didn't get to flee. I didn't get to fight back. I didn't get to use my voice and say, help me. Or I didn't get to reach out for connection and support. No one was there. So those thwarted instincts are kind of sitting, waiting for resolution in our bodies. And so we can start to explore in the process of how yoga, asana practice, invites us into movement. And how might those movements help us find resolution? If you imagine a posture where you're reaching your arms from your core outward, right? And your fingertips are reaching, and how does it feel to re-engage a reach? Or a practice where you just start to shake it out, right? And you shake your arms and you shake your legs, and you can move now, and you're no longer stuck having to be still. Those are really powerful moments where we can really rewire into our nervous system a new experience. And I often put this mindful mobilization before step four, which is mindful immobilization. In reality, we need to know that we can move if we want to, we can move if we can, before the body is willing to go into utter releasing of all of those defensive structures, right? Into that surrendered state.
Yeah, I really appreciate that, because it kind of also can indicate that that other state comes first, or is the default, or that you have to push through it in order to get to the other state.
Exactly. And I think that, for example, if I'm going to teach a trauma-informed yoga nidra practice, the trauma-informed component of that inserts the quality of choice, right? I think about David Emerson's contribution to trauma-sensitive yoga. And he speaks about choice being such an essential component to facilitating safety. And if we're being told just to let go and just to be still and to relax, and that doesn't feel safe in some way, the practice itself can actually be linked to the trauma state. So if we start with choice, notice how it feels, or notice if you would like to let go of any tension in your left arm, knowing that you can actually re-engage that tension at any point, or that you can move at any point. Right? That brings a whole other level of, oh, I'm choosing to let this go rather than being told to let it go.
Super helpful. Anything else on those four steps you want to say in summary?
You know, I would also just add in that sometimes when, you know, if we look at meditation as part of that mindful immobilization or immobilization into stillness, that meditation brought in too quickly or too long of a seated practice too early on in your trauma recovery journey can backfire. It kind of just like what we're describing here. I've, with Yoga Nidra, I've had students over the years tell me that they have felt frozen in meditation or in Shavasana, felt like they couldn't move, or even felt like their depression worsened by practicing those stillness practices for too long, too early. And so I really love to just complement that mindful mobilization once again with the mindful immobilization and to allowing that listening of that step two, that part two of increasing sensory awareness to give you feedback as to whether you need movement or stillness at any given moment.
Yeah, great. So since our audience includes yoga teachers and yoga therapists, it would be great if you can point to some of the additional resources you've got available for those who want to learn more about the subjects. I know you've got an upcoming course in October. I'll share links to your books and articles on YogiU online. Do you want to speak to some of those things?
I'm happy to. Thank you for asking. So, you know, speaking of YogiU Online, we are collaborating together to create a course that's specific to applied polyvagal theory and therapeutic yoga for trauma. And it's based on my new book that came out this past May called Therapeutic Yoga for Trauma, Applying the Principles of Polyvagal Theory for Self-Discovery, Embodied Healing, and Meaningful Change. And that book is written both for teachers who want to apply this model for your students, and it completes the appendix of the book has a 6-week model of an applied course based on, I've been teaching therapeutic yoga for trauma recovery for many years and created this 6-week model that I have in the book. I'll be sharing elements of that with the YogiU online course. I also have two other courses that are currently pre-recorded. One is with the Polyvagal Institute, where I collaborate along with Stephen Porges. And we have a 4-hour course on there that's very specific to applying polyvagal principles to yoga. And then I have a 20-hour course that is with the Embody Lab that is on applied polyvagal theory in yoga. And again, Dr. Stephen Porges joins me for that course. All of these courses that I've described thus far are pre-recorded. I have a live version of this that's going to actually roll into a 30-hour course that's going to start fall of 2023. So if you want to mark your calendars and keep your eye on Embody Lab for that course, it'll be announced in the coming months.
Great. Wonderful. Yeah, those are some excellent resources that I'm sure our audience would love to look into. So finally, I'm curious how and if you practice these regulation techniques yourself and what that might look like on a regular basis for you.
Oh, I love that question. It's kind of my favorite. So I would really start by saying that I kind of live by my daily practice and I build my life around it. Personally, for me, I love a morning practice. It just works well with my nervous system. If I have time at the end of the day, sometimes I'll do a soft restorative practice before bed, but I like an energizing practice in the morning. And my personal yoga practice incorporates these vagus nerve stimulation practices of whether it's eye movements or humming or self-touch based practices, kind of awakening sensory awareness through the skin, pressure point practices of where the vagus nerve travels close to the surface of the skin in the face and around your ears and around your jaw. I honestly recommend that if listeners haven't already checked out my YouTube channel, that's the best way to get a very direct exposure to my daily practice. The YouTube channel is simply Dr. Ariel Schwartz. And I teach these, I've recorded practices all throughout the pandemic, many of them live classes that I've taught that get recorded and put onto YouTube. But I have specific classes on there that are also just vagus nerve stimulation. But for me, when I start my yoga practice, I start every yoga practice both with seated meditation, but also with these vagus nerve stimulation practices for about 15 minutes before I go into more traditional asana.
So helpful. And you know, I oftentimes pretty much always end the podcast with that, because I think we need to hear all the various ways that folks put into practice the yoga, because it can look so different and it is so individualized for you. And this gives us a glimpse into how you work with this stuff as well.
You know, Michelle, as you're speaking about that, I think for me, my morning practice, which tends to be, you know, ideally for me, I like a full hour and a half, even 2 hours, if I've got that space to squeeze all of that in, which I don't always. And even if I can only get 20 minutes, that 20 minutes makes a difference in the day. But, you know, the other thing is kind of like brushing your teeth.
That's right.
We need to repeat this regularly in order to have good oral hygiene. And I think it's, you know, nervous system hygiene and physical and so on and so forth when we practice. And also, stresses are going to happen throughout the day. They're going to happen whether you're driving your car or you've looked at your social media or, right, whatever is happening in your current environment, in our collective environment, what's happening in our world. And so having access to those mini practices, 5 minutes of breathing, or bringing in one of those vagus nerve stimulation practices, you know, gives us opportunities to resolve those stressors as they occur throughout your day. So it doesn't have to accumulate quite so intensely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so helpful. And that's really how we train our yoga therapists too, to think about working with clients to empower them with not only, you know, morning routine or day or evening routine, but things that you can do throughout your day to feel empowered to take charge of where and how you are.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Well, I learned so much from you. Thank you so much for being here today, and keep doing the great work. And I'll share out the things that you've offered so that more folks can take advantage of learning about them too.
Thank you so much. This was really a joyful conversation for me.
If you'd like to learn more about who we are and what we do, visit us at innerpeaceyogatherapy.com.